The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. And now from Drama in Real Life, A Climber's Last Journey. He vanished on Peru's highest mountain. 2 decades later, a stranger brought closure to his family. By Ryan Hawkinsmith. The sounds are terrifying. Cracks, crunches, crumbling. It's as if the enormous mountain outside has come alive tonight and is angry. Or maybe the entire world is falling apart. Either way, all Ryan Cooper can do is lie in his tent and hope the mountain doesn't swallow him up. It's June 2024, and Cooper is high up on one of the world's most daunting mountains, Peru's Huascarán. He and his group count their blessings when the sun comes up the next morning. So far, the trip has been one obstacle after another. Avalanches, rock slides, snowstorms. Cooper is a 44-year-old fitness coach and endurance event organizer from Las Vegas, with a wife and 3 kids back home. He's not sure how many of these international attempts he will be able to make. This has to work out. But it's not meant to be. The group decides that this trip is too dangerous, and they need to turn back. It's the right decision, but it feels so wrong to go all this way and push so hard to get to the top, and now they're just going to quit? As Cooper packs up, the moment keeps stinging worse and worse. He would never risk his own life, or the life of anybody in his group, for the sake of a summit. And yet, he has never made a right decision that pulled his guts out like this one does. The group begins its descent down the mountain. At about 17,000 feet, Cooper notices something dark up ahead. At first, he thinks it's equipment or trash that people left behind. But as the group gets closer, Cooper questions if he's seeing what he thinks he is seeing. When they are only a few feet away, the entire group pauses in shock. It's a body, a frozen body. Cooper is 6'3" and looks 10 years younger than his driver's license alleges. He works out all the time with an eye on peak fitness for summiting mountains, which requires incredible cardio fitness and the strength to endure some of the world's harshest conditions. Still, even on a perfect day, the 22,205-foot Huascarán, the highest peak in Peru, is an almost insurmountable challenge. In rankings of the world's most dangerous mountains, it's been placed near Mount Everest, sometimes higher. And as Cooper sees firsthand, climate change has made Huascarán incredibly volatile. The Cordillera Blanca mountain range, which contains Huascarán, has lost 44% of its glacier area over the past 40 years, causing more melting ice and frequent avalanches. When the group finds the frozen man, everyone stands back and takes out their phones. They want to document everything so they can better aid recovery efforts. After a few minutes, Cooper approaches the body. The man's clothes and equipment indicate that he's been frozen for years. Cooper can see that the man's neck seems to have been broken and that his head also has a significant injury. Perhaps the most jarring thing is the position of his hands. They were raised in a last-second panic to protect himself from what must have been the thousands of pounds of rock, snow, and ice that took his life. An avalanche. As Cooper looks closer, he notices a shiny object on the man's left hand, a wedding ring. He opens the man's fanny pack and finds a driver's license inside. He sees that the man is American. His name is William Stampfel, and he's from Chino, California. The group would later discover that he had disappeared 22 years earlier. Cooper is one of the only Americans in the group, and a feeling steamrolls him that he must do everything possible to get him home. If he can do that, the whole trip will be worth it. Cooper can't get the visual of the wedding ring out of his head. There must be someone out there with a matching ring, wondering what happened to their spouse. He's determined to track them down. The group can't take the body down the mountain. These kinds of peaks are so dangerous that mountaineers must keep their gear to an absolute minimum so there's no wasted energy. The best they can do is document the coordinates, contact the family, and leave the excavation to a trained rescue team. As soon as he gets a cell signal, Cooper connects with his wife and gives her William Stanfill's name and address. He eventually gets contact information for someone named Joseph Stanfill, who he believes is his son. Cooper pauses. How do you even start a conversation like this? Will the person on the other end of the phone be grateful? Devastated? Both? In his hotel room in Peru, he works up the courage to call Joseph Stanfill. It's a New Jersey area code, and the phone just rings and rings. He leaves a voicemail, hangs up, and sends a text. Part of him is glad that Joseph doesn't pick up. Now he has some time to come up with the right thing to say. But a few minutes later, his phone starts to ring. It's that New Jersey area code. When he first listens to Cooper's voicemail, Joseph Stanfill thinks it's a scam. Anybody could have looked up the basic details of his dad's disappearance. But two things stick with him. The first, why would someone scam him 20-plus years later? The second, Cooper's voice. There is a softness that makes Joseph sense kindness, not chicanery. About 15 minutes later, Joseph calls back. Hello, this is Joseph Stanfill, returning your call. Hi, Joseph. My name is Ryan Cooper. I'm in Peru, and I'm sure this is a shock, but I found your dad. Joseph doesn't say anything. He'd accepted that this call might never come. Now it's happening, and he has given up on figuring out what to say next. Cooper fills the air with details. He tells Joseph what his dad was wearing, and that he'd seen his dad's driver's license and taken a bunch of photos. Joseph asks if Cooper could send him the photos, struggling to shake the feeling that this is some sort of cruel joke. But when Cooper texts him the photos, he melts. Now he knows it's real. And when Cooper says, "Tell me about your dad," Joseph finally finds his words. He tells Cooper that Bill Stanfill worked as an engineer. He had two kids, himself and his sister, and two stepsons. Bill would launch himself into projects with complete abandon, including becoming an elite mountaineer. He wasn't the kind of guy who dabbled with playing the guitar or going for hikes. He wouldn't stop until he felt he had mastered it. For the Stanfills, the sadness of Bill's death was outweighed by the pain of his not having mastered his own ending. It was crushing for him, dying to be so open-minded, Joseph says to Cooper. He's silent for a few seconds and then says it again. Crushing. After talking to Cooper, Joseph tracks down his sister, Jennifer Stanfill, his stepmom, Janet Stanfill Raymer, and his dad's brother, Herb Stanfill. Joseph says only that his dad's body has been found. He wants Cooper to tell the full story. When they all sync for a phone call, Cooper recounts what happened. At the end of the call, they all express deep appreciation. Then the family calls each other. Janet had remarried a few years after her husband vanished, and her contact with her stepchildren had dwindled over the years. She moved to Missouri, Joseph relocated to New Jersey, and Jennifer remained in the L.A. area, so the drifts had seemed natural. They are together again, with a finality none of them knew they needed as much as they realized. We had closure, Janet says. Finally. But now they're presented with a new question. How will they get Bill home? For a month after Cooper's voicemail, Joseph Stanfill squeezes his full-time job as an architect around a second job, finding a rescue team in Peru to retrieve his dad. Cooper helps from afar, but getting a body from high on Huascarán to the United States is a complicated ordeal. Joseph needs to book a rescue crew and a police presence to accompany them on the retrieval. He manages to do that from his New Jersey home. Once Bill Stanfill's body is brought to the bottom of the mountain, Joseph must then find a local funeral home to cremate his father's remains and ship them to the U.S., requiring a morass of paperwork. The Peruvian police send out a news release on the day the crew goes to the location of the body. Joseph Stanfill still gets a little hot talking about the tone of the release, which makes it sound as if the police had discovered his dad's body. "Ryan and his group deserve all the credit for finding my dad," he says. The next day, some American media outlets report on the discovery. The family sits down for interviews and signs off on Cooper telling his part of the story. They want the world to know the gratitude they feel toward him. "He's a hero to us," Jennifer Stanfill says. Bill Stanfill's body makes it down the mountain and is cremated. His ashes are shipped to Los Angeles, and Jennifer picks them up at the airport. She opens the package when she gets to her car, and there is her dad, cremated into a 13-pound urn. She cries at the finality of it, but she is so, so happy. The plan is to pour the ashes into three urns. One will go home with her, one will go with Joseph back to New Jersey, and they will hold on to the third until the family can gather on Mount Baldy, the 10,064-foot snowy peak about 50 miles outside Los Angeles, where Bill's climbing career began. They want to scatter the remains around Bill's birthday, November 26. He would have been 81. Jennifer places the urn in the back seat, and a feeling comes over her that her dad is with her in the car. The drive takes about an hour and a half in the L.A. afternoon traffic. Jennifer spends most of the time telling her father that she has managed to merge their shared passion, music, with her career as a teacher. She talks about her side business making purses and jewelry, and knowing that he'd have been her number one customer. She says she can't wait for him to be around Joseph to hear the same life updates from him. She can't help but throw out a spoiler that Joseph named his daughter after him, Wilhelmina. She also expresses the emotional toll of losing him, how this is a sad moment and also a happy moment and also the perfect ending and also so damn funny. "Dad, you hated the cold and that's how you died? Frozen? Really?" she says, laughing into the rearview mirror. "I cried after it first happened," Jennifer recalls later, "but there was so much uncertainty that the crying didn't feel final. I didn't really let it all out. I never had that moment. Having him in my back seat, knowing that this was finally it, I was able to just let it go." In the months after discovering Bill, Cooper has gotten to know the Stanfill family. His favorite part is hearing them talk about Bill. Janet met Bill in the late 1970s. Both were divorced and in their mid-30s, with two kids apiece. She liked how he had his own life and wanted her to have her own life, too. He was the breadwinner, working as a civil engineer, and she was a steady, resilient force that kept their lives humming along. Bill was constantly finding new hobbies and passions. He learned how to play the guitar, harmonica, trumpet, and accordion, and he taught himself woodworking. The common theme of his hobbies was that they were solitary pursuits. Bill liked to work alone. He grew up as an Austrian immigrant in the U.S. right after World War II, picked on nonstop for the thick accent that American kids assumed was German. The anxiety caused him to turn inward and work on getting rid of his accent. Years later, as an adult, he became the kind of man who was so quiet that when he did speak, people listened, and they didn't hear an accent. The one place where Bill felt he could be a little loud was with his family. Janet still remembers the long car rides where the whole gang would sing, "She'll be coming round the mountain, until their throats hurt. Janet told Cooper about how, later in life, Bill discovered what would be his favorite hobby, mountaineering. He climbed Mount Baldy once, and then again, and soon he was doing it once a week, with 65 pounds of cat litter in his backpack as he pushed his body to prepare for bigger peaks. He'd go on to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, Mount Rainier, and a slew of others. When Cooper spoke with Jennifer, she described working for years as an EMT before she went back to school to study music. In 2002, at age 31, she'd gotten her degree to teach music around the time that Bill announced that he was going to try to climb Huascarán. In one of their last conversations, Jennifer delivered great news. She'd been hired as a middle school music teacher in the Los Angeles area. He was so happy for her. She told Cooper that Bill went to Huascarán in June 2002 with two friends, Matthew Richardson and Steve Erskine. In Bill Stamfel's mind, she said, he'd climb Huascarán and then start thinking about trying to summit Mount Everest. He was serious. At age 58, he saw himself on a trajectory to become one of the most successful older climbers in mountaineering history. Bill was a meticulous planner on his summits, to the point that the danger of these trips receded into the background. He knew the truth, though. Plans are not worth the paper they're drawn on if a mountain comes to life. There were other groups on Huascarán the day he disappeared. They reported seeing Bill and his two friends in that area when a massive avalanche swept down the mountain. Erskine's body was found later that week, about 1,000 feet from where Bill's would ultimately be discovered. Richardson's body is still missing. The American Embassy notified Janet that a search helicopter had had no luck finding any sign of her husband or Richardson. It was hard to imagine an outcome other than that Bill had died on Huascarán that day. Joseph and Jennifer, though, held out hope. How could they not? Their dad had always come home. Jennifer thought about the many 1980s movies and TV shows she'd seen where someone gets bonked in the head and has amnesia. Maybe her dad was wandering around a Peruvian village trying to remember who he was. Even if he had died, she wanted to know how. Cooper's heart hurt as he listened to the family talking about how their hopes had dwindled as 2002 wore on. They had celebrated his life on Mount Baldy in a ceremony organized by the local mountaineering community. Still, they'd had a tough time moving on. But as 2002 turned to 2003 and 2004, even Jennifer gave up hope that her dad was alive. "I thought maybe somebody would find him 1,000 years from now," she says. On Sunday, November 24, 2024, the Stample family are gathered once more at Mount Baldy to say their final farewells to Bill. Janet flew in from Missouri. Joseph came from New Jersey. Jennifer drove from her nearby home. And Cooper arrived from Las Vegas. They initially wanted to give everybody the option of either riding the ski lift to the top or climbing the mountain by foot before spreading Bill's ashes. But many of the trails are closed because of fire concerns. Everyone is a bit disappointed, especially Cooper, who hoped to honor Bill by filling his backpack with 65 pounds of rocks and summiting his favorite mountain. They'd all take the ski lift to the top, and Cooper and Joseph talk about someday going to Peru together with some of Bill's ashes, taking him to the summit of Huascarán and leaving part of him where he died trying to get to. Maybe they could look for Matthew Richardson while they are there, they say. At the top of Mount Baldy, a Stample family friend says she had been told by an official that certain trails are okay for hiking. Cooper exchanges a look with Joseph, then they head down the mountain so they can climb right back up. At the base, Cooper finds a rock that might weigh 65 pounds and stuffs it in his backpack. He tells Joseph, "When it gets tough, our thoughts will be with your dad. We're suffering for a good reason." They make the hike to the top, where the rest of the Stample friends and family are waiting. They gather in a circle to say goodbye to Bill, once and for all. A fog has rolled in and surrounds the group. Everybody can see each other, but not far beyond the circle. It's just them in there with Bill. Each person says a few words about Bill, sheds a few tears, and finds closure. Then it's time to go home. The weather is in the mid-40s, but people note that it feels more pleasant than the thermometer would have you believe. As they make their way down the mountain, everybody can't help but smile. Bill Stample is warm again, and he always will be. That was A Climber's Last Journey by Ryan Hawkinsmith. And now for something lighter from Your True Stories, When You Know, You Know. The moment when readers realized they'd found the one. A lifetime of fun. My wife and I met during our first week of college and had gone on many dates by senior year. But I wasn't ready to settle down with one girl until my roommate pointed out that every time I came home from a date, I'd say, it would have been more fun with Elizabeth. It's been more fun with Elizabeth ever since. By Brent McBurney from Alexandria, Virginia. Devotion promotion. My sort of boyfriend went on a road trip from New York City to Buffalo. The day before he was due home, we were texting goodnight, and I mentioned the stressful work day I was in for the next day. He called before I left in the morning and told me to look outside. There he was, parked outside my apartment. He had left Buffalo in the wee hours of the morning to give me a kiss before work and the strength to get through the day. That's when I knew it was time to upgrade him from sort of boyfriend to definitely boyfriend. He was promoted to husband this year and is excelling in the role. By Hattie Jean Hayes from New York, New York. Two people fell that day. An elderly woman stepped off the curb and tumbled to the ground in a store parking lot. My new boyfriend wasted no time rushing to comfort her and check for injuries. He found her broken glasses and crouched by her side until an ambulance came. Today, he's still the same caring, compassionate man I married 23 years ago. By Denise Mallett from Buffalo, West Virginia. A big winner. I'm a huge word nerd married to someone who also appreciates a good anagram. I already had a feeling he was the one when I realized that his name, Sean Morello, made a perfect anagram. No lame loser. Just the sign I was looking for. By Jennifer Morello, Cedar Hills, Utah. Smells like my husband. I was in my 40s, single and removed from the dating scene, when my cousin gave me her season tickets to the Syracuse Symphony Orchestra. I invited a friend of mine to accompany me. Norman and I ended up dating for a few months, symphonies, restaurants, chocolates and roses, before he asked me to marry him. He was a perfect gentleman, and I enjoyed spending time with him. But was I in love? It had only been a few months. I don't know how much time passed as he patiently waited for my answer, but one day my boss came to work wearing Norman's cologne. That did it. I couldn't focus all day and realized I was ready to say yes. By Marion Tickner, Syracuse, New York. A whirlwind romance. My boyfriend and I were at a church event when it began pouring rain. Soon, sirens blared as the storm turned into a tornado. Al realized he had forgotten to close the windows at his parents' house a few miles away, as they had asked. I begged him not to go, but he felt responsible for their home. I faced a decision. Go back to town with him, or stay in the safety of the church basement? I looked in his eyes and knew that whatever happened to him, I wanted to have happen to me. We're still weathering life storms together. By Helen Hoyt, Mayville, North Dakota. Revving my engine. I fell for my mechanic the moment I saw him. He was under the hood in a greasy jumpsuit. He looked up at me with big brown eyes, shaking back long hair hanging around his face. I melted. Then he said, "Your battery terminals just needed to be cleaned. It's on the house." That was it. By Patty Higgins, Lake Wales, Florida. Auntie and Uncle. I was already pretty sure my fiancé was the one, but I knew for certain when I introduced him to my 2-year-old nephew. Lawrence spent hours laughing and playing with the toddler he'd only just met. When it got chilly, he was quick to take off his jacket and wrapped it around the little guy. I know he's going to be a wonderful husband and an even more amazing father. By Brandy Coleman from St. Cloud, Minnesota. I would walk 500 miles. My boyfriend and I had been together for 6 months and were planning to spend the weekend at my parents' house. We'd gotten into an argument the night before, so I told my mom I was coming alone. When my boyfriend figured out that I'd left without him, he called my mom and said he was going to walk the 70 miles. As soon as I got to their house, she filled me in and told me I had better go get him because guys like that don't come around often. I hopped back in the car to retrace the route and found him hitchhiking down the highway toward their house. I knew I'd found my man. By Susan DeSantis, Sims, Edders, Pennsylvania. Bowtie the Knot. One Christmas, my boyfriend and I went to one another's family gatherings. His was informal and comfortable. Mine was a church service requiring formal wear. I didn't realize how badly I wanted my family to form a good first impression until I saw his bright green and pink polka dot bow tie. No good for Christmas, Easter maybe. He graciously changed it. We've been married for 44 years and learned not to care what other people think anymore. By Katie Reiser, Holiday, Utah. And finally, Skip a Beat, Never Town. My ex-husband left after my youngest daughter was born with Down syndrome. Dating when you have children is hard, but dating when you have a child with a disability can feel almost impossible. Mike and I met online, and after messaging and talking on the phone quite a bit, we went on a date. When he brought me home, I said I had something to tell him. He needed to know my daughter had Down syndrome in case he wasn't up for it. He looked at me like I'd lost my mind and said, "And why would that matter?" I assure you, it never has. By Angela Perry from Burgaw, North Carolina. We've run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.